his presence. So Poland moves the minutes from Friday, March 20th, 2009, having thoroughly reviewed them. Any discussion? Yeah, there are a lot of them. Hearing no discussion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. First bill on the agenda will be... Do we have copies? Will be House File 1810.
In Minnesota serving international human trafficking victims. Minnesota is 13th, supposed to be among the top 13 in the nation in terms of numbers of international human trafficking victims. That is because we have a long border, unprotected border with Canada. We have an international port. We have lots of diversity in which international human trafficking victims can be easily hidden. We have Indian reservations, lakes, forests in which they can be hidden. And we also have agricultural occupations in which they can be employed. This legislature has honored the civil society in providing us with the funds for the last 2 years for the crisis and tip line for the state of Minnesota. It's been extraordinarily important. We have received 767 calls in the first 2 years, and in these two years. We also have gotten the trafficking screening clinics, which are extraordinarily successful. We are the NGO that has rescued the greatest number of international human trafficking victims in the country. We also have obtained the greatest number of T visas and U visas, which are necessary for helping human trafficking victims in the country for NGOs. It is because of this innovation and this type of innovation that we will continue to be successful. And right now we have this sign, so you can see that the trafficking victim crisis line has been up and running. This has been contributed to civil society by the Sisters of St. Joseph of Crandallay, this design. And we have the crisis line up and running. This has been translated into 14 different languages. And so I'm going to pass this around so you can see it. This bill that we have before us will continue that innovation and keep us very successful in rescuing human trafficking victims.
Amen. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I want to make sure I understand what we're doing here. Floyd's Bar on the corner of Highway 5 and Tony Road 11 in Victoria. And this bill passes and gets signed into law. Floyd's Bar has never been accused of any kind of prostitution, any kind of human trafficking, any kind of anything. Are they going to have to now create, post, put up a sign, and if they don't do it, they're potentially in trouble?
Chair, Representative Coles, I confess that the bill as it stands right now, it's not my intent. There is language in draft. I've been working with Joe Bagnoli, but is he really the association? Saying that if there were a location for human trafficking certified by the licensing authority, so you had to be certified to be able to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blush, so I understand that where you're intending to go with this is somebody's going to have to be accused. You're talking about certified of having creation in some kind of trafficking offense, right? So Floyd's Bar or Schmitty's Bar in Victoria or the School of Hawaii's in Victoria, since they haven't had any of those accusations, nobody's ever accused them of it, nobody's ever found them of it, they're not going to have to go through the hassle at the expense of putting up a sign like this.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's correct. That said, even for those who do get accused, successfully accused, are certified,
And Representative Blush, Mr. Chair, I don't have a problem with going after businesses that are doing this kind of stuff, but I do have a problem with the assumption that all businesses are doing this kind of stuff. And so I hadn't talked to this attorney all yet. Sounds like United has the same concerns I have. So I'm not sure if we're going to. When are we going to fix this,
Representative Lush? Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, the next committee will fix it. And let me be clear that was my original. I wanted to have it be a blanket effect, and then he just convinced me. He pointed it out to me, and I
should be. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I don't have a problem, for example, with subdivision or with section 2 of your bill, which basically says the reason that you were a nuisance is because you were engaged in this kind of activity, then you got to put up a sign. That makes sense to me. So I'm pleased to hear that you're going to fix this thing.
Representative Bush, is there anyone else, Representative Jeff?
So, yeah, I do want to get this cleared up, too, as well. When it looks at the reason of licensee, are you saying that they would have to have somehow acknowledged or known that this type of activity was going on within their facility or their retail establishment or the fact that it was just happening there and therefore they need to place this sign?
Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Kath. It would have to be certified by the licensing authority. So in situations like that, there are many different criteria that licensees are subject to regarding client centers. So, for example, you didn't know that they were a minor, still get stung. Check. And it is a, as I understand, as I believe it, it is a knowing standard that this was going on. That said, after a certain pattern of conduct, there are certain bars in St. Paul that are routinely locations where prostitutes are picked up. I'll use the example when Sergeant Vic was killed, he had been investigating Eric's bar down there on East 7th, right by the 3M campus that's closed down, which was notorious, and there were a certain number of bars. It's a known location. Cases like that, the local authorities, yeah, okay, we know we've done three arrests there in the last month.
Representative Gaffney, further questions? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, Representative Lesch. Is your intent that we're going to, as I understand, we're going to take this right to public safety tonight, are you intending to have that amendment available for us tonight?
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Olin, I'd like to, if we can, we don't have it yet. That said, this language did meet deadline in the Senate, so we're not up against it tonight.
Any further questions, Representative Olin? Yes. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Lesher, this is going to Commerce then at some point, did you say, or no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hira, yes.
I would imagine that all the issues around this minor matter, maybe, but this whole article with the concealed carry that was all, we have nothing in here about the size of the sign, all that stuff is going to have to be taken care of, I suspect, because the location of it doesn't.
If I may, Chair, yes, and Representative Paymar, that was in the original.
Oh, I see. So you have that in the original.
Yes, it will. It will be. It will all be
recounted. Are any other questions for the testifier or the Representative Lesch? Representative Lesch, is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against this bill?
I guess you have Mr. Magnoli want to testify.
All right. Seat at the table and introduce yourself to our committee and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Joe Bagnoli with the law firm of LeGrand Shea on behalf of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association. I just wanted to 2 points. One, I've had, unfortunately, later than Representative Lesch, I would like to have had a chance to talk about this, and I think that the amendments that you referred to substantially narrow some of the concerns that were met here as drafted. It would apply to the municipal liquor store in Perham, the Metrodome, and State Fair, and it seemed a little bit targeted of what he was going after. I do want to just say, I know I want to trivialize the concerns or the issue that's involved here, because it would be naive if I didn't say that it was a logical place to perhaps post some of these signs in bars. I would also, though, like to say, so I think that going forward, we've had Representative Lesch and I have had conversations, and I think that it will be substantially narrowed. Having said that, I would say we're still not perfectly in support. I think that bars are not the only places where this sort of just to have it centered completely on us and liquor establishments seems focusing too much on us. And folks that engage in this go to convenience stores and elsewhere, and it may be worthy to not just focus on us. I don't want to bring the convenience folks in, but I just want to object to I don't know if I'm being a knife in the back here, but I just wanted to say just that we would have concerns about just being focused on like that at the this sort of thing. That.
Very. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Magnoli. Is there anyone that has a question? Seeing none, Representative Lesch, do you have any other comments? Okay. Representative Lesch renews his motion that House File 1810 has amended. He passed and sent on to the Public Safety Policy Oversight Committee. All in favor, say aye.
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 motion would be that it would be recommended to see an oversight.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. What this bill does is brings us into compliance with some federal regulations. In 2007, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System Improvement Amendment was passed, and that was in response to the shootings at Virginia Tech. And the guidelines have to do with disqualifications for people to carry guns who have been determined to be mentally ill. This bill allows a process for people. It allows us to be able to send information to the National Criminal Incident System so that we can, have that information available to local law enforcement when gun permits are issued. And it also allows for a process for somebody who is disqualified to petition and get that qualification overturned based on more current information. One of the reasons that we wanted to get this bill passed is that the federal government will make funds available for us to input this data into the system. However, we would not be eligible to apply for those funds unless our legislature makes this an allowable purpose area for us. And secondly, if we don't comply with the National Incident Improvement Program, we could stand to lose 10% of our Burn J grant programs, which currently would amount to about $500,000 per year.
Ms. Ellis, are there any questions for the Justice Representative Piemark?
So, Ms. Ellison, so someone has a
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is my understanding. They would have to get information from a psychiatrist or the person, the doctor that they were treated with, to say that they were no longer a danger to themselves or others.
Mr. Chair, is my understanding the federal government requires this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under the National Incident this Act that was passed, they don't require that we do it, but what it is a punishment if we don't do it. So if we decide not to participate in this national data system, the BCA would not be eligible to receive national criminal history grants, and we would have a potential 10% cut to our Burn J funds. So that really is sort of the stick associated with participation or not participating in this effort. At this point, what we want to be able to do is pass this bill so that we can submit some preliminary information to the federal government that is summary in nature, that talks about the numbers of people that would be talking about. We need to collect information from the courts, from local units of government, from our own agency. A lot of the information is contained within the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Then we could determine from there whether or not we should go forward and participate in the program itself. But without passing the legislation, we would miss that opportunity.
Other questions for Representative Piemark? Anyone else wish to testify for or against this bill? No further discussion, Representative Blash renews his motion that House File Number 954 be passed and referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
state the Policy and Oversight Division and moves the voice. Now we're moving the DEE-1 amendment to get in the shape the author wants. All in favor of the DEE-1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Then Representative Ember to your bill as amended.
Members, I'm going to let the experts talk about this. I'll tell you, this is a bill. Actually, the first time it was mentioned, the local prosecutor was about a third. Because of the severe economic issues, we had another, the state is facing, we had another discussion. But it turns out that this has nothing to do with the economics, streamlining a certain process, and that's the $0.05 in DWIs in the state of Minnesota. Explain details, and we'll bring up a prosecutor and that's lawyers to explain this to you. And there are other people who testify as well. There are three basic sections of the bill. The first section deals with the incentive law, in effect, merging that into one process. For those of us that don't understand the details of the incentive situation, one is a civil proceeding, the other one's a criminal. They run on parallel tracks. That's the first part of the bill. The middle part of the bill is something called a D-card, which many legislators, not a much experienced constituents, I found out that was a huge issue. It's an important issue for the state of Minnesota and the attorneys and parties involved in the system, as well as the courts. That has to do with the Intoxilizer 5000. There's an evidentiary issue when it comes to the machine itself. The manufacturer of the machine refused to release the source code to allow defense attorneys to actually verify that the machine was working properly. And as a result, it puts some of the, as I understand it, some of the manual cases at risk. So we've tried to propose a solution to that. Explain to the committee. Mr. Cleary.
Chair and members, record, I'm Jim Cleary from House Research. I help staff DWI and a few other. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to speak from the bill summary. You should have it in front of you. The first page deals with the delete everything amendment. I did not have time today to incorporate that. So if you turn to the second page, you'll find the actual bill summary for House 1305.
Mr. Chairman and members, one
important thing to know about this bill is that, contrary to rumor, it does not abolish administrative license revocation for impaired driving. It does not abolish ALR. What it does is it eliminates the imposition of ALR prior to conviction. So it eliminates the pre-conviction administrative license revocation. It keeps it post-conviction. Now, currently, under current law, there are about 20% of impaired driving offenders who do get ALR, not pre-conviction, but only post-conviction. So it keeps that. What it does, as I said, is eliminates the imposition of civil sanctions prior to conviction. Those civil sanctions are driver's license revocation, commercial vehicle disqualification, vehicle license plate impoundment, and vehicle forfeiture. Now, the way it makes the system more efficient is by eliminating the pretrial sanctions. It also obviates the need for the pretrial judicial and administrative review hearings, or at least most of those hearings. The second important this bill is that it creates a payable fine for first-time DWI defendants, those who comply with the test, take the test, and therefore are facing misdemeanor charges. It does not affect first-time refusers who are facing gross misdemeanor charges. So it would allow a payable fine. That payable fine would be raised to $1,000 Now, it's petty misdemeanor. Once you plead guilty to it, be raised to $1,000 for these offenders, not across the board, but for impaired driving offenders. It also restructures driver's license revocation periods. It makes them three times as long for offenders who do not plead guilty quickly. That's within 30 days of being charged. So if somebody does not plead guilty quickly, they face 90 days, for example, license revocation on a first-time DWI. If they plead guilty quickly, such as through the payable fine, they would face only 30 days, which is currently what they face now upon being convicted, 30 days. Driver's license revocation is higher for those who refuse the test, repeat offenders. And so it preserves and encourages and extends, rather, those provisions of current law. It also restructures a waiting period for people to get a limited license to drive to work or to treatment, or in some cases a higher education or for homemaking. But restructures those waiting periods basically with the thought in mind that it's good to keep a vendor employed. It doesn't allow them to drive wherever they please. They may drive only where the department tells them to the date. And those waiting periods would be one-half the revocation period. So a defendant who pleads guilty quickly gets that conviction on record would be looking at a much smaller waiting period, essentially one-third waiting period, to get that limited license to drive to work. And also, a very important part of this bill is that it establishes a rehabilitation, it restructures rehabilitation requirements for a repeat offender. Makes them just as severe as now, only there would be monitoring as well for a five-year period, following a one-year period of rehabilitation sobriety. So, in other words, they're structured to assure the person's sobriety over that entire period. However, it would shorten the time that it would take for that period to earn a limited license to drive to work. It would also allow for complete rehabilitation at the end of a five-year period. A person's full driving privileges would be reinstated if he reached that point. Currently, rehabilitation periods are for a multiple 3 years upon the first undertaken. If it's done successfully, the person gets a B card. Even a step of one is the example. Communion for a violation of the B card, a person that would then be facing a 3-year license cancellation, and the person takes another sip of wine at Holy Communion, that's an example that would be covered. That person would be looking at a 6-year period of license withdrawal and a lifetime of abstinence. With that lifetime of abstinence, it would be really easy for that person, even with a small amount of alcohol consumption, to violate that and again become subject to another six-year period. And under current law, a person who is canceled has no limited license to drive to work. So the thought is that under current law, it's pretty well known that a person who's subject to cancellation in these long periods of rehabilitation, simply with no work permit, simply learns to live outside of the law. That person learns that he doesn't need a driver's license to drive. He drives without a license. And, of course, without a valid license, you can't have insurance either. So many of these currently canceled people are simply out there driving as they please without insurance. And that's well known. Over 15,000 a year, probably much higher, arrested for driving after cancellation, many following a DWI cancellation. It also establishes a much shorter rehabilitation refresher course for those who just have a B-card violation, those who violate with a little bit of alcohol without driving impaired. They would face a quick 30-day refresher course with a limited license to drive to work after 2 years, followed by a full 5 years of monitoring. And that monitoring would be paid for by themselves, so they would have to pay it with a full license. But in the meantime, be a way to check that they're doing it. Currently, typically, not that sort of monitoring. If you go back to the first page, the page of the bill summary, you'll see that a few other provisions were added very recently. You mentioned the payable fine of $1,000 for a gross misdemeanor penalty, careless or reckless driving that involves a point of fire. Currently, this would make it a gross misdemeanor. Importantly, the bill states that a DWI arrest that results in a plea down to tier list, 15%, maybe 10% of impaired drivers, down to tier list. The law would, or the bill would require that their subject would be subject to the same revocation, and that's the same $680 reinstatement fee. That provision there restores about the bill. We add language on forfeiture that allows a person who is subject to forfeiture, if it has been seized, to come and surrender. Are there any other
questions from members for Mr. Cleary? Mr. Clear, I have a couple questions. By striking the references to or eliminating the imposition of civil sanctions, do the subsequent civil sanctions become then a function of the criminal conviction?
They are subject, and so too would everyone.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Clear. I think those are pretty rare instances where that warning. But that was my question about this. Where effectively, as it stands now, I would say wrong. There's plenty of DWI people in the room, but the majority of the consequences for the DWI result from civil penalties, which the standard is honest evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt. So that is why. My second question is the alcohol monitoring for 5 years, is that the same alcohol monitoring for EHM that we use as $100 a set up and $60 a day?
It would be very exciting.
Question, your theory is the purpose for the wet, careless driving making it a gross misdemeanor. As it stands now, there are many, I think, defense attorneys who would argue that getting out to a careless for the way is actually worse anyway because that's a certification. There are really no benefits that you can add up. So help me understand why we're making a wet, careless gross. Is it because of the first time being a
Mr. Chairman, because this the wet careless as you referred to was actually developed during what 4 or 5 hour meeting we had with all of the experts.
If you don't mind what I do now,
it's called Sean Stokes, who were involved in that meeting, one of them can address right away the question. Because that's where it comes from.
Jeff Sheridan and Sean Stokes, if you would. If they, why don't you just, they just go ahead and do your spiel there.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Sean Stokes. I'm an attorney at the Edward Lammers Law Firm in Stillwater, Minnesota. I've been working with impaired driving cases as a lawyer for about 14 years. I think I have a somewhat unique perspective in that I have worked as a public defender. I've worked as a full-time prosecutor in the county attorney's office. My current practice at Edward Lammers, I do both. My firm represents 13 municipalities in Washington County. We provide all of their prosecution services for non-felony cases. So a lot of my current practice as a prosecutor involves impaired driving cases, misdemeanors, and gross misdemeanors. In addition to that, I do represent private clients in impaired driving matters, primarily outside of Washington County. So I do think I tend to look at these issues objectively. I am here to offer my support on behalf of House File 1305. I reviewed it very carefully. I did participate in the working group and had a chance to speak with Representative Emmer in detail about the bill. At this point, I guess I'd like to say this. If you really understand the current practical effect, the real effect of the implied consent statute as it exists, and you understand the workings of the criminal code, what you'll find is that really what we have is a very significant redundancy. All of the benefits that, or the outcomes or consequences that are made available by the implied consent statute, by 169.852, are also addressed in the criminal provisions of Minnesota's impaired driving code. Specifically, there is, if we took the implied consent statute off the books, we wouldn't lose anything in terms of substantive outcome regarding impaired driving cases. Everything that the implied consent statute provides for in terms of penalties and sanctions is also provided for in the criminal code. And so the question is, why do we have both, particularly in a time when our state is faced with the budget issues that we have? Speaking as a prosecutor, the resource allocation that goes into the implied consent process is extremely significant. We're constantly dealing with our municipal clients with issues relating to the officer time and expense of attending implied consent hearings. It's also a very significant expense and resource issue for the courts. These cases take up a lot of the court's time, and the question is, what's the point? I think that critics of this bill will say the primary difference between what the criminal code provides for relative to the implied consent statute is the immediacy of the revocation. That being, it's the implied consent statute that allows the Department of Transportation, the Department of Public Safety, to revoke you alleged offender's driver's license immediately upon a test which is over the legal limit or upon the refusal. And so I think the critics would say it's not true that the implied consent statute and the criminal code do the same thing, because with the criminal code, it's not until the offender pleads guilty or the offender is found guilty at trial that these penalties would kick in, whereas with the implied consent statute, those penalties are immediate. I think that's the primary argument you'll hear. And I guess my thought on that is the resource allocation that currently exists for these cases, these implied consent cases, is that justified by that narrow benefit? And again, I think critics would say, if you save one life, and they'll say that the statistics show the immediacy of the license revocation does impact recidivism, that being if you take away the offender's license immediately after the impaired driving incident, you will see that there's less recidivism. if you wait, if the offender can drive while the criminal case is pending, then you will lose that reduction in recidivism. But I don't know that that argument really has any logical basis, because here's how it works. When the offender's driver's license is revoked under the implied consent statute, the first thing that happens is they're given a 7-day temporary license. So there's really no such thing as the immediate revocation. The day that the law enforcement officer serves the notice of license revocation, that offender is eligible to drive. They can drive for 7 days. Now, when the 7-day temporary license expires, there is a 15-day period where the offender can't drive under any circumstances. They can't have a valid license. But when that 15 days is up, they're eligible for a restricted license, commonly referred to as a work permit. So with a first-time offender, what you really have under the implied consent statute is a 15-day period where the offender can't drive. As soon as that period is over, they can drive on a restricted license. And then, as was discussed earlier, if the offender ends up pleading guilty, they're going to get their license back 15 days after that. So really, under the current framework, we're talking about a 15-day period, which begins 7 days after the impaired driving incident, whereby the offender cannot legally drive. But which begs another question. You know, people who reoffend, who have multiple impaired driving offenses, aren't typically too concerned about whether they have a valid driver's license. As a prosecutor, it is extraordinarily common that when we're handling an impaired driving case, which is the repeat offense, that there's also a count for driving after revocation or driving without a valid license. So I think this concept that if impaired drivers won't reoffend if they don't have a valid license is questionable in my mind. People that are going to break the law again, drink and drive again, don't typically decide, well, I won't drive because my license isn't valid. I want to quickly address the chairman's question regarding the wet careless, because I think this is the other issue that critics of this bill will point to. And what they're talking about is that it's not uncommon in some jurisdictions for an offender who's charged with an impaired driving offense, particularly if it's a lower test, to plead guilty to careless driving or to reckless driving. Now, in that scenario, if you don't have the implied consent process under the current Minnesota Code, what you would lose is the license revocation, and you would also lose the enhanceability issue. I think, as you all understand, under the current state of the law, either or both, under the implied consent statute or the criminal code, there is the issue of enhanceability. So if the implied consent revocation is sustained, the civil action revoking the offender's license is sustained, the offender is convicted of the impaired driving offense under the criminal code, under 169A, the specific charge of driving under the influence, then that record will be used to enhance a subsequent impaired driving offense, which might occur within 10 years. So the penalties for impaired driving become more serious, not only from a criminal standpoint, but also from the length of license revocation. So if you had a situation where a first-time DUI offender comes to court with a low test, maybe a .08 or a .09, and they reach a plea agreement with the prosecutor and say, well, I'll plead guilty to careless driving. So they enter that guilty plea. If you don't have the implied consent statute in place under the way the criminal code is currently written, then if that offender got a new impaired driving charge within 10 years, there would be nothing to enhance the subsequent offense. So what the wet careless provision does is it says if the prosecutor is going to amend from the charge of DUI to careless driving or reckless driving, then the plea under the appropriate amended subdivision would require license revocation and would require enhancement, so that we wouldn't lose that benefit because the implied consent statute is not in place.
Mr. Stokes, I'm going to stop this for a second and ask you a question about that. You know, my understanding as to why we routinely, .10, we offer jurisdiction over careless is between .10 and now it's .08, so it's careless is between .10. It was kind of a first-time hands kind of thing. Everyone felt better. The lawyers walked out of there. The clients think they got some kind of deal. But it was a first-time thing. We don't do that. The only time I would ever offer, say, a misdemeanor for sort of gross is if you maybe were right on the line at a 2-point. code issues on appeal may disagree, but the technology is good enough where I can establish down to very close to the line, aside from some kind of retrograde extrapolation argument, that they were over. So is it not just kind of a fiction that we offer that in the first place now, and couldn't that be dispensed with under a system like this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's an excellent question. I think currently there's very little benefit to an offender, defendant in a criminal case pleading guilty to careless driving because of the implied consent statute. They're still going to have the license revocation under the implied consent statute. They're still going to have the enhanced ability because of the implied consent statute. So what's the benefit? Careless driving is a misdemeanor by statute, so is impaired driving. So you're right that the lawyer may say to the client, look, I created some value for you, got you convicted of something other than impaired driving. The client may feel better looking at their criminal record going, yeah, I don't have a DUI conviction. But from a practical standpoint, they have the exact same penalties and ramifications as if they were found guilty of the DUI because of the implied consent statute. So what we're talking about is if we take the implied consent statute away, what are we doing with people that might plead guilty to careless driving? If prosecutors are still going to continue that practice, these folks are going to get a substantial benefit. They wouldn't have the license revocation, and they wouldn't have the enhanced ability. Well, that's why we have the wet careless provision, because under that provision, they what? Plead guilty to the careless driving, you still lose your license, you still have the enhanced ability. Well, I'm just going to say something in summary and then conclude. I really think that what you have to look at here is a cost-benefit analysis, and you have to take a hard look at what do you gain from the implied consent statute, and what do you pay for? What's its value? Versus what's its cost. And its costs are very real and very significant. As I indicated, the court resources that go into administering the implied consent statute are quite significant. The law enforcement resources that are allocated to deal with these cases are also quite significant. There are also serious constitutional and due process concerns about this. Fundamentally, what we're talking about here is taking action against offenders before they have been found guilty of any crime. And I'm sure Mr. Sheridan will address this in more detail. But this is, from a lawyer's standpoint, it really calls into question some fundamental constitutional issues, the presumption of innocence, the state's burden of proving guilt, and also the fact that the implied consent revocation can be used to enhance the subsequent offense. It really does implicate some very serious due process questions. So you look at those costs or those concerns relative to what are we getting from the current statutory framework, and it's my position that if you take a hard look at that, you'll see that the statute is currently enacted, it cannot be justified, and that the provisions proposed in House File 1305 are sensible in the best interests of the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll ask you, as best you can, I gathered as much as I look around the room. My name is Jeffrey Sheridan. I am a lawyer in private practice. My practice is limited to defending people charged with crimes. I've been doing that for 22-plus years now, and I have represented people charged with crimes from homicide to rape to everything you can imagine that's on the books today. I will tell you that the one area of practice I find to be the most fascinating is Minnesota's Impaired Driving Code. As I point out to my clients, when I look at the criminal code book here in the state of Minnesota, I find it here in the statute that says it's a crime to go around killing people, and if you do, you got to go to prison for the rest of your life. And that statute occupies 3/4 of 1 page in this book. Minnesota's Impaired Driving Code is 44 pages long. 44 pages that say you shouldn't go around drinking and driving, and if you do, you got to go to jail for a little while. Seems a little excessive for 54 pages. And that's because the Impaired Driving Code is the one and only crime, the only one in the state of Minnesota, where the penalty starts getting handed out before the person ever sits put into a court. When to pass around here for your review. I just grabbed some just from a file that I had on my desk today, a copy of the paperwork that's handed to a person who's arrested for DWI on an item. From the material you're provided there, and I've tried to redact as much as I can. I left enough information so you know that all the paperwork has to do with the same person, not to identify the person himself. It shows that when the person walks out of the door, they have two primary pieces of paper in their hand. One of them is a criminal citation, a summons for them to appear in court. The other is this administrative notice and order of revocation. That's an order revoking the person's driver's license, signed in the dark of night by a police officer who may have virtually no experience whatsoever, and in this case that happens to be true, or a veteran of 30 years on the force. That person decides, under signature, to revoke and take away a person's ability to operate their motor vehicle simply because it was their opinion that the person violated the impaired driving code. And the last page of that shows that not only does the officer have the power to take away the driver's license on the spot, but also that information is then immediately placed on the person's driving record for anyone to see, including the prosecutor, any person who chooses to look at the person's driving record, and certainly the person's insurance company has access to that information. I come today and speak in favor of this bill because, in a very fundamental way, it, in my opinion, is a removal of some of the most un-American provisions I've ever read in a piece of American legislation, and that is the concept that we are punishing people. We are determining that they are guilty, and as the chairman has already noted, the majority of the penalties that people feel, the real-life penalties that a person feels as a result of being involved in an impaired driving case, come not from the criminal prosecution itself, but from all of the other stuff. So I come here today to speak on behalf of those who believe that in this country you are supposed to be presumed innocent, unless the state proves you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And then and only then is it appropriate for the government to mete out punishment against the person because the state has met that burden of proving a person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So I have a very fundamental reason for supporting this, and that is because I believe that to be true, that you aren't supposed to be presumed innocent. I will, however, point out a couple of ways in which the current law is completely inappropriate and an equal protection issue with regard to people of modest means, and that is that to challenge a driver's license revocation and to challenge a DWI, essentially my clients have to fight the government off twice and win twice. To sue to get their driver's license back, and they have to do that within 30 days of the day that the officer puts that notice of revocation in their hand, and show up and defend against the criminal charge. Now, if a person happens to be fortunate enough to be of means and can afford my services, then they'll know, or they'll have the ability to start that lawsuit, and it is a lawsuit against the state of Minnesota to try to prevent that license revocation from taking place. Well, as you'll notice from the material I provided you, the one thing that I've noticed as being almost universally true, and we practice in the suburban area primarily, is that a police officer usually puts a person's first court appearance out after that 30-day statute of limitations with regard to the civil case. So a person who receives a citation with a court date on it can sit there and say, well, I'm going to fight this because I think it was wrong. And they'll show up in court on that 31st day or that 35th day or 38th day. And the first thing that the person who they run into, let's say they're applying for the services of the public defender, the first thing that public defender is going to tell them is, you know what, you are right. You were wrongfully accused here, and we are going to win your case, but guess what? It isn't going to make a darn bit of difference because you sat on your hands for 31 days. Now you have the equivalent of a DWI conviction on your driving record already. And I can tell you, that the people who can afford my services, the people who can fight to keep that from ever happening in the first place, make a heck of a lot more money than most of the people who are introduced into this criminal justice system. There is a very real difference in the way that poor people and rich people are treated in Minnesota's DWI law. I'll also tell you that there is an extremely difficult
dangerous provision in the DWI law that says that if you have a controlled substance that appears on Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 in your system, your license will also be taken away. So if you have a person who is on almost any antidepressant, those appear on Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, any drug that a child may be taking for ADHD, Ritalin, Adderall, any of those drugs appear on Schedule 1 and Schedule 2. So if a person is involved, if a child is involved in a traffic accident and the officer decides he needs to collect a urine sample and it shows positive for Adderall, a commonly prescribed drug for ADHD, that person will lose their license, period. There is no discretion in the Department of Public Safety. If that drug appears, the person's license will be taken. Now, they have the right to challenge it. They get 30 days to sue, and under the current law, the court has 60 days to give them a hearing on this taking of the driver's license before anybody ever bothered. And at that hearing that occurs 30 plus 60 days later, that's the first opportunity a person has to come in and say, I got a prescription from my doctor that says I was supposed to be taking that drug. And the judge says, oh, great, you're right, we never should have taken it in the first place. But you've now sat 90 days without your driver's license, waiting for that day, that one day where you could come in and show that prescription. Can you make that person whole? Does that person now get their job back that they lost 90 days earlier because they were driving a pizza, pizza delivery guy? He's not out of work. These are very real problems that happen to very real people every day of the year. This provision, paid first and ask questions later, has inherent in it all the things that you might imagine go along with take first and ask questions later. This provision, this bill eliminates those by saying, we are going to let you have your day in court, and if you get convicted, you will be punished, and none of the penalties have been reduced. But first we're going to convict you. That, I think, is the most important part of this bill. I can speak to you regarding any of these other provisions. I can see that you want me to move on, and so I will. But with regard to these, the duplicative proceedings, the B-card violation, or the B-card provisions, anything along those lines, to answer those questions, like I said, I've been doing lots and lots of EWIs over the course of the last 22 years. So if you have questions, feel free.
Thank you, Mr. Sheridan. Questions for the testifiers, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Sheridan. For you, the testifier, there is a difference. You talked about the security, you talked about the 30-day challenge, and then you got to have a hearing within 60 days. Are there any differences? I think you have both practice primarily in the Twin Cities. But do you know, are there differences between different parts of the state and how those are handled, and whether there are any challenges either in Greater Minnesota or the metro area that are different?
Sure, Mr. Stokes.
Interesting. Mr. Sheridan, when you refer to the 60-day rule, if you file an implied consent challenge, you sue the state to get your license back, the court is required to give you a hearing within 60 days. That was Mr. Sheridan's case, that's a decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision that said the driver has a due process right to have that hearing within 60 days of when they filed the lawsuit. But in answer to your question, Mr. Representative, Hennepin and Ramsey County have both adopted a policy to get around the 60-day rule, whereby if the driver files the implied consent petition, if they sue the state, they get their license immediately reinstated. The balance of the revocation is stayed until the criminal case is resolved. This is an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. It gets to this question of the benefit of the immediacy of the driver's license revocation. The two biggest counties in the state of Minnesota have already done away with that. Anybody who challenges the implied consent revocation of their license in Hennepin County or Ramsey County is given their license back, period, unless and until they're convicted.
Representative Coles. Why don't we do one other question from Representative Gould?
I just want to make sure I think I understand what you're talking about. I think I'm concerned about it. I live in Carver County, not all that far from the Hennepin County border. And so if he's one of my constituents,
if they're in Carver County, the challenge of the implied consent will get them a hearing within 60 days, but they can't drive during that time period. Their license revocation is in effect. If they're in Eden Prairie, as soon as they file that petition, they're going to get a notice from the Hennepin County Court saying, pursuant to the Chief Judge's standing order, we're not going to give you your hearing within 60 days, but no harm, no foul, we'll give you your license back. And then, again, that's true of Ramsey also.
Thank you. Let's hear from the judge.
James Swenson, I'm the Chief Judge of the 4th Judicial District. That's Hennepin. Here, just to give some statistics, I'm not here to speak on behalf of the judicial branch. It's just the questions that were asked of me. Those statistics are as follows. I have 2007, I don't have 2008. There are 1,832 consent petitions filed in Hennepin County. 271 of those, or 13%, actually proceeded to a trial or a hearing. 1,561, or 85%, were dismissed, or settled, or stricken. I signed, following on the heels of my predecessor, Judge Phelan's order that I referred to, I signed about 50 of my serious people's deny about one deny request for reinstatement while the case is going on. If there's been a fire within a year, underage charge for probation in the class. The vast majority of those are all then conditions are dismissed. They're in court on the criminal matter before they leave the courthouse. Hardly any of those actually. That's the experience.
Thank you, Judge Swenson. I see no questions for Judge Swenson. Are there any questions for any of the other testifiers? I do have two questions. Mr. Sherman, I do take some exception with you. This is the one crime where we do pre-conviction consequences. I'm sure from the average perspective of the typical defendant, they would suggest that any kind of sanction, whether it be bail conditions or, for example, oftentimes we make no contact or as a condition of release in domestic assaults, that those are situations we can have as well. Can you tell me... Mr. Sheridan, can you tell me again how many days do you have to file that implied consent?
From the time a notice and order of license revocation is served, whether it's served by the officer that night, it's 30 days from that day. If it's as a result of a fluid test with notice sent by mail, they have 3 days for the mailing of the notice, so 33 days.
Thank you. And the last question for any of the testifiers, I don't need a question from all of you, but is it true that we're essentially raising the standard of proof here from preponderance of the evidence to reasonable doubt?
For the conviction or for the revocation?
Well, that's the issue, though, isn't it? Because we're in revocation and making it predicated on a criminal conviction.
The result would fall into the consequences that there are post-conviction. That's true.
Do you have any other testifiers in support of the legislation that you have? Okay. Just to be clear, members of the audience, it is our intention to get through this, and we do have a representative champions built up after this. We will go past the hour and a half mark on this, because I do intend to cover both bills tonight. However, there are people who have to leave, so we can move it along. Folks who have to testify in the D card, could you please keep it brief and do not duplicate testimony?
letters to the Department of Public Safety, all with three different reasons. Currently, the no alcohol restriction is unbalanced, unfair. It is unfair due to the fact that other people who have three DWI convictions do not have a no alcohol restriction on their license, nor have they never been through rehabilitation, simply because they fall outside the parameters of the DPS's guidelines. I've had a recent alcohol assessment done in January of this year. It recommends no treatment whatsoever. It does recommend that I continue to go to AA. Under current DPS rehabilitation rules, I'm required to attend rehab at a cost of $3,500, which at the minimum is 8 weeks, 2 nights a week, 3 hours a night, followed by 12 more weeks of AA. All without no license, no public transportation of any kind where I live. And if treatment is not recommended or taken, then the DPS will add another year to my cancellation of my driver's license, which now is 3 years. They would add another year to it if I do not complete treatment. Unbalanced because of the steeper penalties and consequences for driving after cancellation as compared to driving after revocation. I agree with Mr. Cleary that people do drive after cancellation. If I did not have my two daughters, I guarantee you I would be driving. But those are my two daughters who are 19 months old. They're my reason for not driving. I am their sole daycare provider, which brings me to the penalties. I got caught for driving. I would spend 90 days in jail, a gross misdemeanor, compared to someone who got caught driving without revocation or suspension. I would face the impoundment of my plates, and if caught driving with my daughters, I'd face child endangerment charges. Restriction is discriminative because a person with a B card can be turned down employment, be refused entry into any establishment that serves alcohol, even if they're going in there just to eat dinner. Because someone with a B card is considered a person of questionable character. All this happened to me. Lastly, I don't believe someone should come here and ask you for help if they're not willing to do their part. I've done my part in my community trying to improve public safety. Let's take away the license of a drug dealer and make it harder for them to find a buyer. Or take the license away from a child molester to make it more difficult for them to find their next victim. Not from someone who has never been in an at-fault accident in their life, who has gone the past 17 years without a moving violation of any kind, who has actually done something for public safety. I would like to see the violation of the no alcohol restriction be in concert with a conviction of a moving violation rather than simply consuming alcohol in one's own home, which is what I was doing when I violated this restriction. After all, it's a conviction of a moving violation that is the result of the no alcohol restriction. On behalf of my wife and daughters, I'd like to thank you all again for giving me the opportunity to speak before you today. And it is my hopes that we can find common and balanced ground in dealing with the B card restriction. One other comment I'd just quickly like to make. I found it online this morning. It happened in Wisconsin. I realize they have different bylaws. There was a gal in Wisconsin who was convicted for 3 DWIs in 3 days. Her punishment is 30 days in jail and a $3,500 fine. Compared to what I have lost, a pension, my job, numerous other things, I'll trade my penalty for her penalty. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bullock, are there any questions from the testifier? Seeing none, we'll move on to our next testifier. Welcome to our committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tom Bortless, and I'm from Glencoe. I'll keep this real brief. Anyway, I would just like to start off by saying that I do applaud the state of Massachusetts efforts in trying to keep drunk drivers off the roads, state highways, and local streets and stuff. opportunity to say that with the efforts the state has put into the program on the streets, there needs to be a limit as to what is considered overboard and unfair practices on moving violations or the driving violations. Anybody who has a B-card, the gentleman earlier, I've completed all the required things that this court has told me to do, has required me to do. I've gone to jail, I've done, the 3 months, I've done AA. I paid all my fines, I was sober for eight years. With that being said, the state is still not happy with what I've done. Meeting the requirements and everything. And because of that, they're asking me to have a lifetime ban, something that is legal for anybody sitting in this room to do and anybody that's going to be. And I just think that is really unfair, and it seems to me like it's maybe even borderline unjust. I don't know, maybe I'm borderline that. And the fact of the matter is, I was doing it in a safe manner. Conversation with a local officer. I was riding my 18-speed bicycle up to the store to get something to eat. It's not like I was buying a car or doing anything that was endangering anybody else. And since I did pick up drinking again, I'll admit I still enjoy beer. I ain't gonna lie to you guys, I do. But I didn't write. I didn't drink and drive before I learned my lesson. It took me a long time, but I did learn. And as far as my consequences, since I've lost my driver's license for being intoxicated on 18, I was making about $60 to $75 a year. I had to take a part-time job making $10 an hour. I've been able to gain $15 an hour, but it's just about half of what I'm barely able to make my monthly bills. I had to sell almost a brand new car. Because of that, I'm paying a loan, $8,000 loan on my vehicle. So you drive around town once in a while. I don't get to touch it, I had to spend most of 2007 sick because I had to walk to Grant's only about 8 blocks, but once 24.
That's long 8 blocks.
I had my medical bill in 2007 that were about $13,000. I spent a week in the hospital morning because of this. Obviously, my family situation has really suffered. She had to go from Jordan to Montcalm out here. She got taken back to Montcalm all the way to Jordan. Me and my wife has worked basically on the verge of divorce over all this. And in closing, basically, the only thing I would like to say, is that, I'm just one of many people that are so afraid to leave this state because the most ridiculous thing there is, I called, and I told Mr. Shemansky about it. I called about 15 states after I got states saying that my license was getting suspended or canceled. There's not another state in this nation that's ever even heard of this. In fact, my home out California, they laughed at me. They go, you gotta be kidding. I said, no. And so this is really unfair, and it's way overboard. What the state is trying to do as far as keeping from.
That's my Mr. Borden. Testifiers in opposition.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of clarification. The B card requirements, the rehabilitation requirements that are being referred to in the testimony, are not in the statute. They're all in the rules.
Thanks for that clarification, Mr. Chairman. Please proceed and introduce yourself to the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Steve Simon. I'm on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm also the head of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DUI Task Force, been in that capacity for about 25 years. I also do fairly extensive empirical research on Minnesota's DUI laws. The core point I want to make is that ALR is deemed and defined really as a quick administrative license revocation that occurs close in time to the behavior that triggered it, has been proven and shown to be significantly effective in reducing reducing crashes and reducing alcohol-related deaths and injuries by up to 30% in some areas. And my own research shows significant differences in recidivism, significantly higher recidivism when the license revocation is delayed past 30 days. One of the comments was made by Mr. Stokes, who Mr. Stokes is a student of mine. I guess I've been doing this too long. This was as Representative Coles. But in any event, when I looked at plate impoundment, and we found the effect of recidivism of a quick plate impoundment, which occurs to second-time offenders, basically the time for arrest, versus the delayed plate impoundment, again, we saw significantly higher recidivism with the delayed administrative action, delayed plate impoundment. It's kind of like the classic theory of parenting and criminal law. When your kid misbehaves, you get their attention by doing something. It's more, it's not what you do, it's how quickly you do it that is effective. Bottom line is, the reason that we have, and we are one of 40 states that have, basically at the time of arrest, administrative license revocation, and other administrative sanctions, the reason that we have that is it's proven to be much more effective than our criminal DWI laws. And that's the reason why I'm here to testify in opposition to this. There's also concerns that if you eliminate implied consent, there is a very significant likelihood that there will be an increase in jury trials. People charged with DWI, particularly first-time offenders, who don't have to fight the revocation, very likely, or more likely, will go to trial on the DWI case because they just have to roll the dice once. So when you talk about cost savings, I think that you probably go the wrong way there. Now, there are things that can be done to streamline the challenge process. I'd also like to point out that Mr. Sheridan was not candid with you. There is an administrative review process for somebody who's experiencing an implied consent revocation. It's fairly informal. It's fairly quick. You have to at the department, and if there's something wrong in Mr. Sheridan's case, I think if he were to furnish them with the prescription, there's very likely an administrative review might have gotten his client's license back much quicker. But there is written into the statute a very quick administrative review of that license action. That's the main point. The two main points I want to make is that the significant effect on traffic safety. And some quick numbers, we kill about 200 people a year with alcohol-related traffic crashes. We injure about 4,000, and that's consistent throughout the country. For every alcohol-related death, there's about 20 injuries. So this is a public health safety issue. Another point to make, we talk about the two-track system. There, any licensed behavior in the state, a person with that license is subject to a two-track system. Your electricians, your teachers, your nurses are subject to a license action as well as a criminal prosecution if the behavior that implicates their license is also criminal. So this is not an isolated type of behavior.
Thank you, Professor Simon.
One more point I'd like to make. I don't know if someone's here from the insurance industry. It's very likely that every driver's insurance rates would increase if the insurance company cannot accurately experience rate each individual driver. In Minnesota, less than 1% of the people who are arrested for an alcohol-related incident are successful in removing that challenge. And consequently, our rates are based on, that person's rates are based on his driving conduct. You go back to a system that we had 50 years ago, you're going to go back to the insurance company. In order for us to accurately protect ourselves in Minnesota, we're going to have to raise everybody's rates because we will never know if any one driver has prior alcohol-related incidents. Thank you.
Questions from members of the committee for Professor Simon. Seeing none of the other testifiers in opposition to the LCR, not seeing any discussion. Oh, sir. I missed someone testifying in opposition. If you have testimony that doesn't duplicate previous testimony? If you can be brief, why don't you step forward? He's testifying in favor.
I am Sherman Locksmith. In my life, I've had 3 WIs in senior period, all right on the limit of 0.10. Myself, I don't think I had a drinking problem. I had a drinking and driving problem. I have not had a DWI in over 8 years. In that time frame, carrying my B card, working as an auto mechanic with certified jobs, with every surgeon on there, adults preventing me from being on the fire department, since they will not allow anybody to use certain license. October 25th of 08, I was followed for a couple miles and then pulled over with the officers at the loading spot. I was not pulled over for any direct reason for illegal activity. The officer asked me if I had been drinking, and I told him yes. He gave me all field tests, passed them all. He also gave me a breath test, which I also passed. The officer gave me a citation for the D-card violation and impounded my truck. I believe the officer profiled me. I ran a license plate, saw the D-card, never seen it pull me over. For that reason alone. He said he's supposed to take me to jail because it was a gross misdemeanor, but he had bigger fish to fry, so he gave me a ride home. My license was taken for detention for 3 years. I received a $1,000 fine, all state but 200 plus fees. I received 160 days in jail, all state but 20. I received a bill for probation supervision of $205, $300 for the house arrest program, and $150 to return out the impound lot. In September of this year, I lost my, I'm sorry, 2008, I lost my job as an auto mechanic due to problems. Then in October, I lost my license, not for breaking the law, but for breaking an administrator's rule. Without my license, I've had no luck finding a job as an auto mechanic, which is all I know, because I can't test drive cars, and it affects their insurance if they're hiring me. I'm a single father to a beautiful 7-year-old girl. I no longer can drive her to church on Wednesdays or Sundays. I can't go eat lunch or at school on a regular basis like I always did. We would spend every weekend up north fishing. This year we went ice fishing twice. We will no longer be on the motorcycle this summer. We miss family fun nights at our school because I was on house arrest. I'm on unemployment. I have no one in my house to help me with money or rides. I bought 2 flights to get custody of my daughter and take her away from mom that was addicted to meth. Now she's mine, and I feel like she's being punished for my past. I'm not going to sit here and tell any of you people that people don't deserve to be punished for their actions, or people don't deserve to be punished for life. People can change. Some people learn from their punishment. Some people grow up. Some people have children. I mean, the world's going to make them change, and some of them may have another reason. All the things I did were wrong. I paid my debt. Let's finish out my life with a normal life that I screwed up a long time ago. 34 years old, I still have a chance to be on the fire department and help people. I know it's hard to make laws to fit everybody in every case, but there is a way, but the way the law stands now, there is no one will ever change. If we all work together, we can come up with laws that will allow people who have changed to continue to work, to raise their kids, to support their family, fulfill their dreams, whatever they may be. But still keep DWI strong and certain that I don't want to change. Thank you for speaking for me.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have an additional testifier who identifies herself as neutral on the bill. Is that individual saying, would you step forward? And please be brief. I would note that Mr. Stokes has requested him to testify. Members of the committee and members of the audience, this bill will be going to a committee starting at 6:30 as well. Will be additional opportunities there. We're already over time. Please, sir, identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Lemons. I'm what's called the Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor for the state of Minnesota. This is a position that was created relatively recently, 2007, by the U.S. Department of Transportation, and it's funded federally by that federal agency. I think it was Mr. Boland who mentioned the lady in Wisconsin that recently got sentenced for 3 DWIs in 3 days, and she got 30 days in jail in Wisconsin. I would ask you to consider what that lady would get here under this bill. The first day she gets picked up for DWI, guess what? It's a petty misdemeanor. It's a payable offense. There's no license revocation. There's no license plate impoundment. Nothing to prevent her from driving again. The second day she gets picked up for DWI, and we can't use the previous night for enhancement because, guess what, there's no license revocation to use for
picked up. And guess what? We can't use the previous two offenses for enhancement. There's no plate impoundment to prevent her from driving on that night either. And guess what? That third offense in 3 days, that too is a payable offense with a $1,000 fine. Mr. Sheridan mentioned that the DWI statute is significantly longer than the murder statute. And I suggest to you that that's because statistics show that you are 10 times more likely to be killed on the roadways than you are to be murdered. As Mr. Simon mentioned, we have 200 people every year being killed in alcohol-related fatalities. That's one every other day person that is killed in an alcohol-related fatality. So this is it. This is important work that we're doing, and these changes in this bill, these are not modest changes. These are not small changes. These are major changes that are being proposed without any type of study or evidence gathering. I would like to mention that the Office of Traffic Safety, who I work closely with as they administer my federal grant, they've been working the last several months. They have a large group comprised of numerous people, public defenders, treatment providers, prosecutors, all kinds of traffic stakeholders, working on coming up with improvements to the driver's license sanctions. And I would suggest, in reference to the arguments in regard to the B card and all the driver's license sanctions that we're talking about, let's let them do their job. Let's let them gather the empirical evidence. Let them brainstorm and see what they can come up with to design a better system rather than basing it upon anecdotal evidence. I would also point out that the immediacy of the license revocation is important. Every study that has been done has shown that this reduces recidivism. I know the proponents of this bill have argued that it does not, that they have not cited a single study that shows the contrary. Every study that's been done shows that it reduces recidivism. Just to give you an example, a study that was done recently in 2007 found that the administrative license revocation saves approximately 800 lives every year. There was a study done in 1991 that found that it reduces recidivism by 13%. So as Mr. Simon got into, there's numerous studies that show that it reduces recidivism, which saves the courts on numerous DWIs because they don't have to prosecute all those subsequent DWIs or hear them. As far as duplicating the implied consent, I understand what this bill is trying to accomplish is to consolidate things into one hearing, into a criminal hearing, implied consent hearing, so we don't have all these separate hearings. However, it is allowed under the current statute to combine the hearings so that you do the implied consent with the omnibus hearing in the criminal case. That's utilized, that's done right here in Minnesota to save resources. That's currently being done, and it's allowed by the statute. As far as Mr. Sheridan's arguments regarding due process, equal protection, that's been reviewed by our appellate courts numerous times, and they've always rejected those arguments. I wanted to point something out regarding the vehicle forfeiture statute. I'm looking at, I think it was line 22.22. If you look at the vehicle forfeiture statute, they've completely deleted out the judicial forfeiture proceeding. So once somebody's convicted, then the vehicle's supposed to be subject to forfeiture. However, if someone has an innocent owner defense or one of these other defenses that they're allowed to appraise, and interestingly, I noticed they left the innocent owner defense in the bill, and they have to show that by clear and convincing evidence. But I don't know how they're supposed to do that if they never get their day in court. If there's no judicial forfeiture procedure, I guess I'm not sure how they're supposed to prove an innocent owner. With regard to the source code, this has been an issue.
Mr. Lundis, if you can, we do have one more bill up tonight, so if you could wrap up your testimony as quickly as possible, I'd appreciate that.
I would just say that this is an enormous bill. There's a number of important changes that are being made here, and I just think that we need to consider it a little bit more. I understand what they're trying to do. They're trying to streamline the system, trying to avoid the duplication. I understand that. I think the devil is in the details. I would suggest that we give it more study, that we allow the Office of Traffic Safety to finish their study that they're doing on driver's license sanctions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lemons. Representative Emmer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for listening to the testimony. As for the last gentleman, I would just hopefully, if this is lucky enough to make it out of your committee and go to the next one, he and I will sit down and I will explain to him the things that he has clearly missed. We are not talking about going to a system 50 years ago. We're talking about consolidating. We're talking about improving. We're talking about protecting ALR. We're not talking about eliminating it. We're not talking about reducing penalties. Not at all. This is actually an attempt to do some really good things with the good work that's already been done by Professor Simon and others, and I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Member Representative Coles renews his motion that this House file,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Coles renews his motion that House File 1305, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. And members of the audience, that hearing will be in Base 400 North. At 6:30. So if you would like to be heard on that, if you can get an opportunity, proceed there. Representative Champion, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for listening to my bill. We're going to try to make it as fast as possible once you get this bill back before the committee.
Representative Champion, Chair would move your bill that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to and public safety policy and oversight. So please proceed your bill.
And we do have one amendment, Mr. Chair, which is the DE-1. Have the chair move DE-1 amendment.
I'm Representative Champion. All in favor of the DE-1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
If I might, this committee should remember that we came for this wonderful committee not long ago, and we were in the process of finalizing some language with the Minnesota Association and some others, and the DE-1 amendment that you just adopted is a reflection of that coming together with the Minnesota County Attorney's Association. I will have quickly Mark from the Council on Crime and Justice to just go through the agreed upon amendment, as well as
welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hazi. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Council on Crime and Justice. And a goal of the Council on Crime and Justice to enhance public safety by making it easier for ex-offenders, and actually those we'll be talking about tonight, those who have been in contact with the law and have not been convicted, make it easier for them to find employment, housing, and lives. That's the extent of my editorial comments tonight. Let's jump right into the amendments in the bill. But I do need to give you just a little bit of background on expungement. I think it's really important to understand this. In Minnesota, there's two types of expungement, two ways to get an expungement. One is through what's called statutory, which is by following the statute 609A. The other is inherent authority, and that's under the inherent authority of the courts. In a statutory expungement, because the legislature has given us authority in the statute, the judge can seal all the records of an offense or non-conviction when somebody gets it through the statutory route, executive branch, BCA, police, judicial. The statute currently covers three different types of offenses: low-level drug offenses, juvenile adult certifications, and then what are called in the statute are called cases resolved in the person's favor. Anything outside of that, which is all convictions at all levels, and I'll talk about the ones that don't fall under resolved in favor of, are inherent authority. And the problem with this is in Minnesota recently, Supreme Court, an appellate court case law, they said that because of separation of branches, the court does not have the authority, or this isn't real clear yet, but this is the way it's going, that the court doesn't have the authority to steal executive branch records, the PCA records, and police records that the employer or landlord can get. So what we have with the case law in the current statute is, and who we're trying to reach in this, the folks that we're trying to help move along with the statute are those that didn't get ultimately convicted, but were not, the case wasn't resolved in their favor. The court has interpreted resolved in their favor to mean that they never admitted to the facts, never pled guilty, and for some diversion programs in some counties, the person has to admit to the facts. First days of adjudication, they have to have admitted guilt before they can finally, if they can successfully complete probation, they're told they won't have a conviction on the record, but it's still on the record, and so it causes problems with disemployment and housing. So what this bill does is it adds those diversions and stays to the statutory expungement so that a judge can steal all the records of somebody who successfully completed diversion or successfully completed the terms of a stay of adjudication. It does one other thing, and this is in Section 2, which is a procedural change that makes it a little bit easier for somebody to get an expungement in these dismissed types of cases. Some people might have some safety concerns with that. We don't want to make it too easy to have somebody get their records. What we did in Section 6 is the prosecutor, only the prosecutor has the power to initiate that process. And they're the ones that know the case. And so what that Section 2 does is does have a prosecutor can request to have the record sealed at the time of dismissal. And that addresses two types of cases. One is the person who ends up in court charged. Once he gets there, even the prosecutor wonders why they're in court. It was either misidentification, DNA evidence comes back, but they're going to have this thing on their record. And under current statute, they have to file a petition, file a court date, maybe travel somewhere else to get the court date, do all the paperwork. They can't pay for a lawyer. It's difficult to find public assistance on these cases. So it addresses both cases with it's clear that the person shouldn't have been charged. The other type of case is, and I think this can be a good tool in the prosecutor's toolkit, is somebody that qualifies for diversion or a stay of adjudication, the prosecutor can say, Mr. Jones, if you successfully complete this, you will get an expungement at the end of this. You won't have to come back. And we've been working very closely with the County Attorneys Association, like Representative Champion said, as well as the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I don't know if they can say that they support all this exact language, but what they'll say is that they're fine with this going forward here as is, and then we're going to work on the Senate side to make a few small tweaks. I mean, we pretty much know what we need to do on the small changes.
So thank you, Mr. Rounds. Question from Representative Colts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe more of a comment to Representative Champion. Thank you for your continued efforts on this, and thank you for agreeing to work with people on both sides of this issue and people who have concerns about it. Representative Champion, as I understand it, there are still a couple little tweaks that maybe needed to have as Representative
Representative, that is our commitment, and we have a great working relationship, and we are all in it together.